New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. So now get two snack wraps plus fries and a medium soft drink for just $8.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi folks, welcome to the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters, episode 74, William the Conqueror Part 2. So in this episode, I'm joined by Beau, and we are going to be talking about the Norman invasion of England, because it deserved its own entire episode, frankly. I don't want to skim over any of it, because it's such an important event in this country's history.
God, yeah, I mean, massive, isn't it, really? Yeah. It's one of the first things you learn, again, before recent years, when our own history seems to be deliberately put on the back burner. In the before times, it would be
when
one of the
we
first things
young.
You learn, isn't it?
Yeah, when we were young, it was an important event in school and in English history. Now, but anyway.
Not so much. But so, it seems to be, it is sort of a watermark moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
All historians agree 1066 is just, from the point of view of a historian, it's just a perfect turning point.
Yeah.
To mention.
Because you get those years throughout history where it's like the fall of Constantinople. It's
right.
convenient to mark the changes of different epochs at these points, you know, and 1066 is one of them. And the thing is, I do think that the Norman Conquest does fundamentally change the sort of character of England, because it's really insular before then. Like England, the English aren't imperial in any way, shape or form. They don't seem to have any desire to, you know, own Scotland or Wales or Ireland or France or anything like that. This is all the Normans, as far as I'm concerned. And it's just very, very interesting, I think. The Normans basically use England as like a base of resources to start just conquering everything.
Yeah, absolutely. The sort of the English character, for want of a better phrase, is just heavily stamped with Normanness.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, there's just no denying that, heavily. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the kings for generations after this spoke French, not English.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just one thing to say about sort of Scotland and things. Later, it will be in another epochs. William launches a campaign into Scotland. Mm. And I was reading a thing just the other day saying it was only Athelstan had done that. So it wasn't common. It wasn't usual. Because in later history, it's quite usual. We have endless back and forths with Scotland. But until then, it was...
And Æthelstan only did that because the Scots got involved with us, didn't they?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so it wasn't like he was like, right, your land's mine now. You were coming down here. Go away. Go back.
Same reason
to
why William does it in the 1070s.
Yeah.
It's because he sort of had to, because the King Malcolm just kept harbouring his enemies.
Right, okay. So as we previously covered, it is possible that there is a legitimate claim that William, as legitimate a claim to England that William has as Harold Godwinson, because Edward the Confessor may well have actually pledged the throne of England to him, because he had no children of his own, and Edward the Confessor married to Emma of Normandy, deeply connected to the Norman court. He may actually be the legitimate successor.
Yeah, I mean, you can say the Harold Godwinson and William of Normandy both have a claim.
Mm.
You can say that both of those claims are really weak as well, though, can't you?
You can. Yeah.
And a lot of people argue that the true heir should have been Edgar the Atheling, who at this point in 1066 is still a teenager.
Right.
And not sort of a badass teenager.
William.
A normal sort of teenager who still is controlled by the powerful magnates around him.
Yeah.
But he's like a nephew or great-nephew of Edward the Confessor. And I will be talking about Edgar Atheling a little bit in this one, but probably leave more of his story for a later one.
Okay.
Because he does come into it. He isn't sort of immediately killed or anything. Mm. So he does come into it. I'd like to do today the battle and maybe hopefully also his William's coronation.
We'll see how it goes.
Spoiler alert, if nobody knows...
Yeah, if you didn't know, you know.
William the Conqueror does win the Battle of Hastings. So, all right, so should we get into it?
Yeah.
All right, so we talked about in another one, the one with Harold Hardrada, that there was a battle up north, mm-hmm. at Stamford Bridge, mm-hmm. But a smaller battle just before that, Fulford. And the two earls that fought in that, Morcar and Edwine, the brother earls of Mercia and Northumbria, were there. And they come into it a bit later. So I've got a line here from Sir Charles Oman that talks about basically Harold Godwinson's kind of position at this point. Mm. Oman says, but to appease the stern Duke of Normandy, he knew was impossible. And he looked for nothing but war from that quarter. Indeed, he was hardly mounted on the throne before William sent over ambassadors to formally bid him fulfil his oath and resign the crown, or take the consequences. It need hardly be added that Harold replied... that the Witan's choice was his mandate and that his oath had been extorted by force.
So, yeah, just in case you missed the last episode, Harold had found himself washed up on the coast of France, went to the Norman court, and apparently gave an oath to William, the bastard, that he would support him in his succession to the throne of England. And Harold appears to have gone back on that now.
Yeah, apparently swore on sort of sacred relics and things, sort of as serious as an oath can be.
Yeah.
However, there was one historian I was reading, might be Nicholas Vincent, who was saying that even in those days, it was accepted that if an oath is extorted out of you, though, it's not, it's fair dues to sort of go back on it. It's like if you're forced to marry someone, it's sort of okay just to declare it null at some point because...
And there's no doubt that Harold was within William's power, so, it's not like he could have said no.
Yeah.
So...
No, absolutely. So William, in his mind, all the accounts agree that he's not going to have it.
Unsurprisingly.
He's not going to roll over and just accept that Godwinson is now the King of England. He's just not going to have it. Oman goes on, the Duke of Normandy was firmly resolved to assert his baseless claim to the throne. See, Oman says it's baseless.
I think that's very patriotic, but I don't think it is actually baseless.
It's not entirely baseless. No. I would call it weak, but it's not baseless.
I agree. I think they're both actually fairly weak claims, to be honest. Yeah. But, they're the most powerful men with claims. So,
but it's certainly not utterly baseless.
No, not at all.
But it says, his baseless claim to the throne by force of arms. He had a large treasure and many bold vassals, but he knew that his own strength was insufficient for such an enterprise as the invasion of England. Accordingly, he proclaimed his purpose all over Western Europe and offered lands and spoil in England to every adventurer who would take up arms in his cause.
Mm. And this is how he built his large coalition.
So let's talk about that, because apparently it did take him a while. It's big. The numbers are disputed, and I'll talk about that in a little bit of detail in a minute. But something in the order of 7,000 to 12,000, probably something like 10,000 men.
Yeah, that's the number that's traditionally given.
Right.
Yeah, about 10,000 on each side.
And there's lots of debate between the original sources and subsequent historians over who had the bigger army, because the original sources are completely at odds with each other. Some say Harold's host was vastly bigger.
Really?
Yeah, and some say no. William's army was sort of unparalleled. It had hardly ever been seen before. But it's modern scholarship seems to suggest, or does suggest, that they're pretty much the same.
Yeah.
On some sort of parity.
Yeah, I've read a lot about the Battle of Hastings, and of all the sources I've read, I've never read anything that really indicates there's a significant numerical advantage on one side or the other.
Right.
You know, even if it's 9,000 on one and 10,000 on the other, that's not very significant, frankly.
So one thing, just a quick word to say at this point, again, about the sources, is that the main ones here are William of Poitiers, who's actually there, saw things with his own eyes. The other one I mentioned before is a poem called The Carmen, or its full name is The Carmen de Hastingay Proelio, but people just call it The Carmen, by, we don't know exactly, but they think it's by the Bishop of Amiens,
right.
Guy d'Amiens. who again it was sort of contemporary. And so serious scholars sort of look to those two and compare those two against each other very, very closely. What is omitted, what's stressed, all that sort of thing. And then there's later histories like Aldrich Vitalis and things. And we've got the Dee Chronicle. There's all sorts of various, I've mentioned before, various versions of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. The main one is the Dee Chronicle for this point. So just one more line from Charles Oman about William's preparations. Oman wrote, William's military preparations were so great that he was able to enlist thousands of mercenaries from France, Brittany, Flanders and Aquitaine. Of the great army that he mustered at the port of St. Valery, only one third were native Normans. William took 6 months for his preparations. He had to build a fleet since Harold had a navy able to keep the channel. So that's interesting, isn't it?
Well, he's got Alfred's navy, hasn't he?
Yeah, or some of it.
the descendant components of it.
Yeah. So one of the main things that always gets mentioned is that that William the Conqueror's army was held up from crossing the channel by bad weather. Sort of a month or more of bad weather. It seems he spent all of August, or just say the dates, it's famously the 14th of October, is the Battle of Hastings. So that's the date we're heading towards here. And mainly you want to do your fighting in the summer, usually, nearly always. And he apparently spent all of August getting his army together, lots of horses as well. And the logistics of that is interesting. How much hay and fodder you need, how much horse waste will there be? People say tons and tons and tons. How is it possible, kind of thing?
But, I always wonder this about ancient logistics. They must have worked really, really hard, frankly.
And, at first he mustered them at a place called Dives, or the mouth of the River Dives in France. And then they went across to a bit further along the coast to St. Valery. So there's a bit more detail for you there. But basically the weather prevented them from just hopping across when they wanted to. And so it wasn't until late September, we think either the 27th or the 28th of September. And so again, modern historians sort of argue about that and talk about that. Was it purely the case that the weather just prevented them from doing that? Because it seems like quite a long window of time where there was no break in the weather. Seems unlikely, totally possible, but seems a bit unlikely. Or was it possibly, I don't know if I put much joy in this, but was it possibly a deliberate ploy by William, hoping that either Harold Godwinson would be defeated up north and there would just be chaos in England, which would be to his advantage, or even that Harold's army, the Fyrd, would disband because it's too late in the summer now?
Yeah.
Because that's a thing that comes up loads. Right, yeah. So if he could wait until they disband in September, late September, then he could bounce across and there's sort of no one opposing him. So was it maybe deliberate? They think it probably was just the weather.
Well,
we don't know.
I mean, it's, I suppose from William's perspective, if the weather has been really rough for the past 2 weeks, really, really rough, and then you've got like a day of clear water, you'd be like, I'm not risking it. You know, I want a good week of clear weather before I take the biggest army I'll ever see across on this dangerous journey. Because, you know, one storm could sink the entire thing and then that's it. You're dead as well. So, you know, I could see prudence being a factor. Even if you've got a few clear days every now and again, you'd be like, no, I'm not taking that risk.
And to state the obvious, it is a massive gamble. The whole thing is just one massive gamble. Yeah. So you've got to be quite careful. Yeah.
And it's not like Harold hasn't like just crushed the Vikings. You know, it's not like Harold can't win battles.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the everything is to play for. The stakes are incredibly high. And it's not a guarantee that William's going to win at all. And in fact, it doesn't look at parts like he is going to win. You know, so it's incredibly risky.
Yeah, Harold Godwinson has just bested Hardrada, killed Hardrada, arguably the most famous, greatest warrior in the world, sort of thing, in the Western world. So, yeah, it's obviously no pushover. From William of Poitou, he says, tempest and continuous rain stopped them from crossing over.
But it's entirely plausible.
The Carmen says he had something in the order of 700 ships.
That's a lot of ships.
That's a lot. That's big.
It's a very big fleet.
For the 11th century.
That'd be big for the Romans.
Yeah.
that's a big fleet.
And we see in the Bayeux Tapestry, it shows them Like loading up all the horses and all this thing. The Bay of Tapestry is great. But where he went across to from Dives to St. Valery and had to stay there for a while, seems like some people lost their nerve because there's some accounts of deserters at that point saying, is this thing ever going to happen? It's like late September now. It's some of us have got to go back and till the fields and whatever.
Yeah.
And you said it was going to be all over by the end of summer. It's the end of summer now. What's going on? Well, another line from William of Poitiers, who I will be quoting a fair bit in this, because he's the best. It's much longer than the Carmen, so he's pretty much the best source, primary source. He says that the ships look like, quote, like a flock of doves. All the men getting into the ships, these thousands, maybe 10,000 men getting into ships, were like a flock of doves seeking their lofts. The throngs of infantry rushed to take their places on the boats. There's just no doubt that it's a big invasion attempt. It's not half-assed in any way.
No. William's putting everything he has into this.
Yeah. Really rolling the dice. It really is. And so either on the 27th or the 28th of September, around evening time, when the tide is at the right ebb, they launch out. And it's from St. Valery to Pevensey, where they actually originally landed, which is very near Hastings. You know, it's in that part of the world, absolutely. I'll put a map up. That's about 60-odd miles, because everyone knows from Dover to Calais is the shortest possible distance. But still, they went, it's about 60-odd miles. If you're travelling in a ship of those days, it's not more than 2, 3, 4 knots. It takes like 12 hours to do that. It's not, because when you get a ferry from Dover to Calais nowadays, it's like, what, 40 minutes?
Yeah, something like that.
Whereas it's like 12 hours for them to make this crossing. And it's not unfraught with danger, should we say.
No, not at all.
Because the weather could turn. The English Channel is famous for the weather turning. Yeah. And suddenly what was a calm sea is just massive breakers. Yeah.
Is why I suggest that William might actually have been like, we'll wait for the weather to,
It's not stupid.
No, not
absolutely
at all.
It's the right call. It's absolutely the right call. I mean, it's sort of, you just can't, if the channel is in a tempest, you just can't attempt it in those vessels, of that day. So they go all through the night. William's ship, we know, is called the Mora. We don't really know why, but it was his ship was called the Mora. And it had, it was quite often done, even in the Spanish Armada, the lead ship would have a lantern or some sort of light at the back of it for everyone else to follow. And that's what he did. And when the sun comes up the following day, William and his ship find themselves just on their own. They've gone too far ahead. And they're completely on their own, just off the coast, just near Pevensey Bay, which is a great place to land. Because just the way it is, it's a great place to beat ships and things. He's all on his own, basically. And there's apparently a bit of a panic aboard his ship.
Well, unsurprisingly. So where's my fleet?
Yeah. Wait.
Where's my giant army?
It's all gone awry immediately. Yeah. But apparently William's response to that was like, calm down. And he just ordered breakfast on his ship, including spiced wine, we're told.
Yeah.
We're told that he just sat down calmly, quote, as if he were in his hall at home. But then, soon enough, they see sort of four ships coming over the horizon or within sight. And then the rest of the invasion force. And we're told, William Poitiers says, they look like, quote, a dense forest whose trees bore sails. Great lines, isn't it? All this sort of thing.
Very imaginative.
So when they do, and then they do land on either the morning of the 28th or the 29th of September. One little story is that when William disembarks, he immediately fell down.
Doesn't this happen to Julius Caesar?
It's a trope. It's almost a trope.
Absolutely,
pretty much a trope.
Yeah.
And so some say, oh, that's a terrible omen. He's got unsure footing. God doesn't really want, he's not behind this because he just fell over.
As you say, it's a trope. But the thing is it always seems to happen only to the successful men.
Like never
that trope applied to the unsuccessful men.
Well,
you know, Harold Hardrada didn't fall on the beach, did he? You know,
right.
It's just interesting.
You're quite right.
Yeah.
If this little anecdote is true, apparently he laughed it off by saying, "Like I've already grasped with my hands the land of England."
I'm reasonably sure that's exactly what Julius Caesar's claimed to have said as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's obvious BS made up after the fact. I don't know why they thought that was a cool story. It's just not true. Sorry.
Well, one thing to say about that sort of thing now is that historians always copy each other. Always. Yes.
Yeah.
When you read the history of Churchill, he's copied Oman loads. In fact, he just copies lines from Tacitus here and there, almost verbatim. And that's in the modern age.
Right.
In the medieval times or before, sometimes they would copy whole pages from Tacitus or Suetonius.
Yeah.
They would just take a character description from Suetonius and say, this is what Charlemagne is like or something.
Yeah.
And it's like, seems to be word for word, the Latin word for word of what Suetonius said, but okay. And one example of that is that they said William the Conqueror was quite abstemious with his drink. And there is directly a line from Suetonius talking about Augustus. Just an example.
I was going to say, I'm not adverse to them, like, quoting, you know, here's Suetonius' description of Caesar or whatever, because it's like, you know, the closest description in time, whatever you have to that person. And so you want to, you've got nothing to innovate there, right? It's like, I don't know. I have no idea. This is just what he's, I'm not adverse to that. But like, yeah, copying like line for line and then just applying that line to someone, in, you know, that you're writing about, that's very lazy.
Yeah.
Very lazy.
Yeah. Cutting paste in the name of the guy you're talking about in place of Augustus.
Yeah.
Well, one thing could be that, say, William the Conqueror was actually abstemious with his wine.
Well, have been.
And so you're like, well, here's a great famous passage that everyone knows and loves. It might not be like really underhanded. It's more sort of just the convention. It's just sort of what was done. To us, it looks lazy.
Yeah.
But maybe it's not exactly that.
As Suetonius said of Augustus, right. William was.
Right, yeah.
You know, and you would not be criticized in any way for saying that. You know, it would be fine.
Well, sometimes they take biblical lines from things. Yeah. And again, everyone would, not everyone, but lots of people would sort of know. Mm. So, oh, that's the tip of the cap to something from the Old Testament or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, so William and his army land at Pevensey. Apparently there was an old Iron Age fort there that he immediately sort of does up and, you know, makes better, makes usable.
Occupies.
And that's what he does with a couple of other places. So they go along to Hastings, because again, say the battle's on the 14th of October, so there's still a good couple of weeks here, isn't he? He goes along to Hastings, and again, there's an old fort there, sort of from time immemorial, which he does up, and like the tapestry shows them building a motte, a fake hill that you can defend and make palisades and ramparts around and build a castle, actually, probably of wood in the first instance, but later in stone. So they do that a couple of times.
If there's one thing that an army's useful for, it's building things. This is just one of those things that's throughout all of history. It's like, I've got 10,000 men and none of them are doing anything, but they all have to do exactly as I say. Go and chop down some trees, you know, like we did the one of the first epochs talking about how the Roman camp was built by the soldiers. It took an hour in the evening. Now, I'm sure that William took a lot more than an hour, but like, you know, 10,000 men is a good labor force.
You know? It's good to keep them busy.
Yeah, exactly.
Because these are a lot of them, especially mercenaries, adventurers, should we say.
These are not the reliable, trustworthy, noble types.
Yeah, they're not like, you know, 19th century infantry divisions that you order to do something and they kind of exactly do it. It's not like that at all. These men will sort of do as they please and do bad things. Well, the tapestry shows us all the horses coming off off the ships and stuff. But so it seems that the Normans do immediately start sort of pillaging and ravaging and burning everything.
What a shock.
A sort of a famous-ish bit in one of the more famous segments of the Bayeux Tapestry, which shows Normans burning down houses and women and children fleeing for their lives and things. Because it seems that what William did, his logistics, were that when they were still in France mustering, he would provide all the fodder and everything needed. But once they've bounced across the channel, it's every man for himself. It's foraging.
Yeah, yeah, well, they have to.
And so at what point does foraging become ravaging, you know?
Well, I mean, depends who's writing the story, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
You know, for the English, they were ravaging the countryside, but for the Normans, they were foraging the countryside. But yeah, no, that doesn't surprise me at all, though. And I don't, you know, it would have happened either way for anyone. You know, if we were invading them, we would have done the same. So
quite possibly.
Just normal course of events.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty much par for the course.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to switch just over to Harold real briefly, he's up north. He just fought the Battle of Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, he's thinking, wow, that was a tough year, wasn't it, lads?
Yeah. Yeah, surely that'll be one of the biggest tests of my reign. Thank God I passed.
Yeah, exactly.
And so
he must have had some indication that William was going to come, though.
Well, I mean, as I said, one of the Omen quotes, it was he'd already sent him a letter as soon as he became king, saying, "You're going to, I am the king, right?" Yeah. So he knew, he didn't come out of clear blue sky.
Right, okay.
So York is something in the order of 270-odd miles down to the south coast, something in that order. And it would have been, again, the exact timings of this aren't known, but we think it would have been 2 or 3 days after the Battle of Stamford Bridge, he would have got a herald, he would have got a messenger saying the Duke of Normandy has landed. Mm. And so, sort of famously, Harold speeds south.
Yeah, really quickly.
Super quick. It was famous how quickly he got up there, but he comes back in like 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
270 miles in 4 or 5 days. That's lightning quick.
This is Julius Caesar levels of marching your infantry around.
Also, that's the thing people say, it must have been only really the mounted men.
Hmm.
So that's one thing that sort of the primary school level, armchair level histories don't make clear, but it must have been the case that most of the unmounted men stayed in the north and all his mounted men sped south.
Mm.
And then they got levies on the way and from the southern counties, places like East Anglia and Wessex, which is Harold's seat, Sussex, places like that. So a lot of the unmounted men of the north followed behind him, but more slowly.
Mm.
Because you just cannot march men that fast.
No. Oh, and at least not expect 50 them
to miles be a day is not possible.
And not expect them to be useful at the end of either. Yeah, you know, even if you did somehow force march them day and night, you know, there would be nothing on the battlefield. It would be no good at all.
Yeah. And you can't march men 24 hours a day.
No.
Not for more than a day or two on the trot. You just can't do that. So anyway, that's something to mention. It wasn't just simply the whole army that fought at Stamford Bridge all come south like that. It's more staggered.
Yeah.
And that's why when he ends up in London, or just before the actual battle itself, with less men than he might have hoped.
Mm.
But we'll get into that. There's one thing I think a great note is that William knew that Harold Godwinson had gone north to fight Hardrada and an invasion from Scandinavia. And he wouldn't have got word of the result of that battle until he landed in Pevensey or some point after that. So in other words, before he's crossing the channel, he wouldn't have known which Harold he's going to have to fight.
Yeah.
I think that's, I don't know why, it always brings a smile to my face, the realisation of that.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Switching between tools for one project gets disjointed, especially on tight deadlines. Grammarly built a game-changing writing surface tailor-made for professionals to help you move your ideas forward and sharpen your writing. You can brainstorm ideas, summarize meeting notes in seconds, or strengthen a proposal without context switching. Easy to get started and even easier to finish. Sign up for Grammarly free and get your professional writing from draft to done. Visit Grammarly.com. That's Grammarly.com.